Well, I think the very nature of the artistic act itself as an act of transgression is an act of opposing particular behaviors, but not only opposing them and stopping at the opposition itself or the critique itself, but in fact transcending that into ways of reconfiguring and reorganizing that which we are opposing. So that implies a creative act of beginning to dismantle and reorganizing and realigning protocols and behaviors. But much of the stuff that happens in the context of opposition stops at the bitching, at the kind of just, you know, confronting without any possible tunnels of possibility, carving ways into, you know, that very system we are trying to confront. So I think that this is a different gradation of confrontation, mm-hmm. which is less of a mask and a facade. It's more a kind of procedure, it's an itinerary, it's a charting of a course of action, which ultimately emblematizes what for me is the political itself. It's a set of decisions that one makes to course, to set a kind of trajectory. That's also the creative act. It's a different interpretation of that, but that's the reason I was saying it doesn't relate to evading. Because I understand then where you are taking the word. I mean, because you want to evade the stupidity of this backward, you know, and to engage into a more ideal state.
Your practice you have an expanded definition of practice, right? You're at once an architect and you're more than an architect. You're at once a passionate proponent of an advocacy kind of based approach, but you also do more than that. You have an artistic and a fundamentally creative perspective onto all that you do. How do you situate your practice? Not just how do you find others situating you within various disciplines or schools, but how do you yourself situate your practice? How do you position yourself in your own words?
Much of it departing from a disillusionment with existing protocols, if I can use that word again, or within my own profession, you know, that have not advanced not only the culture of its own milieu, I mean, in terms of architecture, but realizing that the only possibility of producing what I would aspire to imagine as an experimental work would imply an advancement also of the existing socio-political and economic frameworks that have defined the products by which we just operate. One of the dictums, if I can call it that, of one of the activists that I've been working with in San Isidro, Andrea, is that no advances in affordable housing design can be made without advances in housing policy and housing economy as we know it. And so therefore that implies an expanded mode of practice where one would have to enter into understanding the logics of the very protocols of financing, of lending, and of land use, of regulatory types of frameworks, to begin to find spaces, again, of opportunity embedded not only in those logics, or to completely formulate new logics based on other type of conditions and finding points of entry into that. So all of a sudden one becomes takes the position of being the interlocutor in the midst of those, you know, those conditions. So that's another aspect of the kind of expanded modality, let's say, of practice, is that not only one would have to begin designing process itself, designing the conditions themselves within which more experimentation could occur, but also what are the conditions that are invisible to those institutions that we are trying to what is not being acknowledged, right? So in a sense, there is another aspect that I'm interested in the practice, which has to do with translation and transcription of those invisible conditions that are embedded in some of these environments that I work with. So translating the value of the hidden in terms of translating the value of informal economies and systems of social organization, of interface that some of these nonprofits produce within those communities, become very interesting devices to formulate new types of regulatory frameworks or even the very nature of economy. There is a kind of missing link that has been inoperative in terms of practice, in terms of architecture, and this is one of producing new systems of representation on one end, but also transcribing some of those very interesting procedures embedded in those environments. And that's part of the, you know, the challenge is that then the practice becomes one hybrid of research-based type of efforts, communicational systems, new forms of dialogue and conversation, new forms of pedagogy at the scale of the urban, and so on. To the point that a lot of the interest has also been in designing what the community workshop should be about, you know, what is it about, because it's been perpetuated as this very patronizing thing that hasn't really advanced anything. It just becomes a symbolic, once more, facade of engaging communities just to understand that what they like, what they want, and just to provide that. But it's been proven that it's not necessarily that the community knows what it wants. Sometimes it is also ignorant of what it also is already doing. So how one comes in to amplify what the community is already doing. In other words, part of the issue here is that is to problematize the debate across these already very disjointed factions and you know, spheres and so on. So I've been interested in rethinking the workshop model to problematize the discussion and to demystify certain concepts that have been taken for granted. And many architects don't want to get to that because they don't want to seem like colonizers or... So it's a mutual kind of interpenetration. One, the architect here becoming one of revealing certain potentialities that might not be considered, while at the same time vulnerable enough to really accept and absorb certain idiosyncrasies embedded in those environments to transform particular spatial recipes that we tend to most of the time impose. Yeah, it's a typical thing. It's like this mutual recognition. But so again, I mentioned maybe two or three examples, but when I think of expanded modes of practice, it probably some of those would be the most important ones, is having to do with the possibility that we as architects can, besides designing objects, we also can design processes, policy itself, economy, in so doing also becoming translators of informal dynamics, of new forms of communicational systems, and rethinking what research means in this process.
I'm interested in the way that you would or would not identify as an activist, insofar as, for me, an activist often has a micropolitics as their kind of goal or outcome, right? They may be advocating for a particular issue, they may be kind of fighting, struggling, to enact a particular kind of change. But it seems that you have a more macroscopic perspective. So when you talk about the political, you're talking about social, environmental, economic, and so many other issues.
I was reflecting on the project that we did in Buenos Aires, where we met this person who became the interlocutor in the community to understand the issues, because we were new to this environment, in this shantytown in the middle of Buenos Aires. This person was just really a housewife, in a sense, who had just been thrown into this moment of conflict as she became the defender of this group of immigrants who had been the newcomers into the shantytown, who wanted to be, they were being evicted, not by the police initially, but the dwellers who already belonged there, and then the police and so on. But she, during a year and a half, became the representative of these people, and became aware of the law, and became aware of processes that could be employed to defend them, to carve a position for them. And so I began to suggest that, in my mind at least, that the activist was that sort of figure who really integrated what has been divided, in a sense, across many of those domains that have been, in fact, peripheral to our own practices as architects. Because she had a kind of social, political, economic history of that environment. She was thrown into the conflict. She became a researcher. You know, she would never say this, but she became, she amassed this sort of knowledge that then allowed her to propose a set of steps with these people and so on. So, well, at times, of course, we continue to perpetuate this insularity, how we call it, of specialization based on. I think that at the end of the day, the call that is being made at this moment, mainly because certain creative practices have rendered themselves obsolete in their kind of distancing from the problems and the kind of sites of conflict and so on, and is that we need to just re-engage those socioeconomic and political domains that have been peripheral to our thinking. Not just to for the sake of, you know, being responsible, and no, but because embedded in those logics there is huge space for experimentation. And the realignment of those would produce even sites for new practices to emerge. And this is what these people really lead. You know, they manifest that possibility. But of course, they don't call themselves artists. They don't, you know, but they establish and they kind of choreograph and produce a set of, procedures, you know, that allows them to rethink the institutions themselves. I've been dwelling on that thought a lot when thinking about citizenship as a creative act, not as a kind of emblem of some kind of symbolic belonging to a nation state through paperwork and whatever, but really the very act of constructing not only the city, but reorganizing certain protocols. Creative deeds, everyday deeds that rethink and reorganize behaviors and institutional frameworks. That's the reason I think immigrants, in my imagination, continue to be the citizens of, you know, really the citizens that are building the city of today, because they are literally not only specialized and, you know, through illegality, these alternative densities and so on, but also because they, in the process of dealing with their own vicissitudes and subsistence and existence, they have to reconfigure those protocols around them. Anyway, but that's, I'm thinking, that's what becomes, the activist suggests the integration of those aspects. It's not just putting a Zapatista mask on yourself and all of this, you know, it's enacting, it's a course of action, but it's really embedded in and infiltrates itself in the context of institutional rigidity. It's an act of encroachment within those protocols.
Is there a relationship between activism and creativity and imagination?
I think that would be the triad. I mean, in reality, this is fantastic, yeah.
And is that what your practice is aspiring towards? Or you feel like that's what you're literally, that is what your practice is? Is your practice kind of fundamentally kind of situated at the intersection of the imaginative, the creative, and the activist kind of?
I would want to aspire to that, yes. I mean, I think that part of what we were saying is that, you know, I've been dissatisfied with the way, in fact, sometimes there are certain aspects of activism that really turn me off as well, you know, where there is sort of this massive kind of reaction and protest, which is important, but I many times feel how subordinated we become, you know. Doesn't matter how many times, how strong we scream, but we always continue to be relegated to this, you know, group of juvenile, you know, protesters that are expressing themselves, but nobody is really again proposing how to move forward. I mean, what are the steps that are required? And I mean, it's just in Korea right now, that project is building models of the neighborhoods that are going to be demolished in Korea, in this satellite city. That was the part of the project, is that to build the models of these sections of these neighborhoods that are going to be demolished by developers. So we engage the activists within these neighborhoods and students and collectively to build these models that reproduce exactly the spaces. But as we were building the models, we used the models as an excuse to talk about the value of those spaces, how they perform across social economic registers, how the new developments being built by the kind of monopoly of development agencies, construction companies, and government institutions were ignoring the kind of issues of urban agriculture, I mean, the kind of macroeconomic systems that were at play, the social thresholds or spaces that were essential to the organization of housing in those older environments. So they were completely erasing all of that. So when we spoke to the activists, we found out that they were just going to protest in front of the municipality, but they didn't have any language with them. They didn't have any way of expressing or suggesting that these spaces are valuable because of this, this, and that, and they can be essential. So it's not about saying that, you know, being protectionist of these environments or these neighborhoods in Korea. It was a way of saying, okay, fine, the city needs to transform because higher densities are needed and other types. But can it do so through the understanding of the value of the existing, not just tabula rasa, right, approach. So I began to realize that, or not began, but I began to, I confirmed that, again, even the most potent activists are misinformed and operating based on particular clichés of what protest means, but not armed with tools. Usually they are conceptual tools, extending from the reality, the everyday reality of, you know, as activists working on the ground. But I think that we as professionals seemingly can also help to amplify that reality with more abstract systems of representation at times or language. So this sort of, again, this issue back of public scholarship, right, of pairing different types of knowledge to produce new procedures. So I mean, that's why we began to talk about this. I'm thinking of the issue of when the question... Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Pairing imagination, activism, and creative practice, right? I mean, that's where this begins to... And that was also... Now I'm thinking that another layer of this expanded notion of practice is one where we are also producing or designing new systems of collaboration, I think. Because this has to be tactical. It's not just, oh, let's collaborate, let's be around the table, let's be together. But the collaboration has to be calibrated. How do you hybridize the language of an activist like Andreas Correpa in San Isidro with the representational systems of maps and cartographies that we do here? Right? How do we produce a map that is clear and simple enough to trigger the imagination of a person inside the neighborhood that is not accustomed to that, but also can inspire the imagination of the politician who is in charge of leading the kind of policy that will shape the destiny of this environment. You know what I'm saying? So it's like it's an interesting way of thinking about new modes of interface with the public across institutions and so on. But it's weird because this might sound like wishy-washy, this sort of, okay, let's all be together. And say, no, it that's the reason it's another type of confrontation. But needs to be designed, needs to be orchestrated. But I think that you're right. I mean, I would aspire to think that the practice then is framed by that aspiration of triangulating across the imagination, you know, the creative thinking that, how did you call it yesterday, the creative...
creative administration?
The creative... a creative opposition, you know.
Well, one of the other ways that you've been creative about opposition, or you've enacted a creative opposition, is that you're constantly calibrating, or at least I think that you are, you're constantly calibrating and refining your practice. The last few days, the last few years, we've always been talking about how other texts, other practices, offer potential models or concepts that can be applied to our own. So, I don't know, could you talk about your practice as one that's not just about the advocacy or the kind of community workshop kind of sensibility that you might be indebted to, but also fundamentally your practice as one of trying to kind of like process and apply and test and experiment with a variety of methodologies. Am I being clear in a way? I mean, would you think of that as your practice, too? In other words, like a constantly shifting
Well,
experimental dispositional.
Yes. No, I think I hate to go back to the same anecdote of General Petraeus. Okay, because it's very relevant to that. Can I mention that, or because it's too recorded, or too? No, I mentioned to you that three main statements in the last 3 years that were very fundamental in inspiring and supporting and clarifying issues. Well, one was by Tania Bruguera, because recently I wrote a little piece called Returning Duchamp's Urinal to the Bathroom, which is a conversation with Tania Bruguera when she said, you know, as frustrated as she was, like me, in terms of the issues right now and the role of artists and art and cultural institutions, and she said, you know, maybe this is the time, this time of crisis, is the time to finally restore Duchamp's urinal to the bathroom. But she was, again, arguing for this more functional relationship of art to everyday, to the everyday. That had been hijacked by the kind of bastardization of what the conceptual means in the context of representational systems and modes of display and institutions and so on. Hopefully it's a momentary return, because I also respect, you know, the tradition. So on one hand was that, and on the other was this statement by General Petraeus, you know, when he came back from Iraq, suggesting that the contemporary soldier needed to transform. This is the first report he gave to Congress. They had to transform, you know, being less this robot-like figure armed with all these gadgets, controlling the world from a distance, that the contemporary soldier had to become a social worker, a cultural anthropologist, versed in many languages, because the war was not fought at a distance from above, from somewhere, you know, out of a push of a button, but it was fought on the streets themselves, at the scale of neighborhoods, you know, engaged in these rhizomatic forces, social networks, familiar relations. But very interesting words that he was using, because it got to the, you know, summarized a lot of the issues. For me, it has been not a critical distance, but a critical proximity to the scale of very local configurations that are really more where the conflict ultimately ends up being manifested and spatialized and so on. So this critical proximity to the institutions, to the kind of conditions themselves that have produced the conflict, then become the material for design, for the artist. But also he was getting at something really interesting when speaking about interdisciplinarity, of how we transcribe and translate and connect. He was not suggesting that we should become all social workers, but can we borrow the procedures of the social worker so that we can also, through a process of, you know, how would you call it? I mean, of translation, we can alter our own protocols, our own systems, and so on. So that has been of interest to me. One example has been, it has been impossible to get to articulate spatially these projects in San Isidro, in these neighborhoods, architecturally speaking, without understanding, let's say, the conditions themselves at this moment of financing. So I have to borrow the logics of the developer unavoidably. I have to understand how the spreadsheet works for a performer, where pockets of profit are hidden, where are the numbers coming in terms of different sources, whether it's a loan by the bank or tax credit driven system. You know what I'm saying? So to reconfigure the spreadsheet itself, to also understand the limitations of certain subsidy driven housing, by which they just become really abstract, because they look at dwellers in neighborhoods and housing complexes like this as customers. They're abstract. They are just entities that are in need, but they are. So we want to link our housing projects to specific characters, specific actors, specific people who are collaborating and enabled, because also they are in need. And so very soon I begin to realize that many of the projects have depended on this, we haven't talked about this maybe before, but, and I'll get to it maybe for a moment, but the point is, yes, understanding how a developer performs and works so that we can alter those performance, maybe with less margins of profit, and maybe with more pixelation in terms of sources, and maybe with more specificity in terms of who are the characters, and maybe with camouflage in certain topics or items that might not call retail what it is, but something else. And so it needs. So, but without understanding those logics, we want to be subordinated to the bottom line of the private developer, and you know, and so on. Mainly when our project has been enabling neighborhoods, in this case, to become developers of their own housing project. But the broad issue here, in terms of the reference to other texts or other procedures from the other other fields, is maybe which could be maybe one major overarching idea that has been inspirational to me, is to move from levels of neutrality and abstraction to specificity, to more specific reconfiguration of the system themselves. It's something that I've been thinking a lot about it. Okwi Ewensor, you know, in a conversation we had here at UCSD, was talking about that as well, the need to move from the public as a kind of abstract, public space as an abstract, neutral notion, where all of a sudden, but just by producing this, people will magically appear and meet, which has been the way that we treat this project. He said we have to move away from the public as an abstract idea into issues of specificity, which I took as issues of rights. You know, rights of access, rights, you know, the rights themselves. Because the construction of rights would imply, you know, a very specific set of aspirations that are like these. You know what I mean? So anyway, but that to me became enabling of thinking there is no way to really advance, again, the nature of our work without understanding the logic of the developer. In fact, the way of imagining the kind of, you know, the protocols embedded in the politics of the shaping of density or zoning, and ultimately in the way an activist like Andreas Kurepa operates in her engagement of the community. So borrowing some of those procedures, mm-hmm. contaminating our own with those momentarily, because I also believe in, of course, disciplinarity. I mean, we do what we do because we need to offer something that comes from a vantage point of what we are able to do and know how to do. But sometimes we become so obsessed with our own protocols and procedures. And that's what continues to be imposed on others. So, I don't know if that...
I mean, I want to stay on this topic, but I want to kind of ask it from a different perspective. Like, to your right, there's Korb's sketchbooks, Le Corbusier's sketchbooks. How do you read those sketchbooks? Do you read them as kind of potential tools to apply or to kind of sources to recover, perhaps, in the service of a contemporary practice? Like, how do you read... on the most fundamental level, not just how do you understand the importance of studying the economic or the developer's kind of handbook and to do what you do, but how do you read kind of, you know, why do you spend so much time reading philosophical texts or thinking through philosophical ideas? How is it that you read the historical?
Well, I mean, this is probably speaking in ideal terms because I wish I could read more, right? I mean, part of my problem, and maybe is a little bit of my strength a bit, I don't know, I mean, is just to move quickly through things. I mean, as, all, you know, you, and, you know, but I don't dwell too much on the specificity of certain texts or their comprehensiveness. I mean, I just move through fragments, you know, and I love really the connection across fragments, whether it is the conflation of Le Corbusier somehow, you know, enabling moments such as the, you know, Team 10 into Rem Koolhaas, or, you know, certain traditions are conflating into each other, the kind of blind spots that really have been, that remain inoperative when it comes to understanding the meaning of those movements and so on. So, part what I'm trying to say is that I like to be an editor. Like, I edit a lot. I just take, you know, because part of the issue of opposition is that we've become so embedded into this, so obsessed with particular ideological positions that then we completely eliminate everything else that is not connected to that. And I tend to give the benefit of the doubt to even the most, you know, You know what I mean? Like, meaningless at times, or, you know, even though I should say that, you know, like, I'm a kind of critic of new urbanism, like, with, like, almost like as much as I abhor the right, you know, the right wing Republicans, you know, in my way of thinking. But what I'm trying to say is that there is a way of reading some of those texts, not through how they are niched or how they belong to a particular tradition, but how through those texts we can extract fragments which ultimately become concepts, which ultimately become malleable and flexible concepts that frame ways of operating. And so I'm interested in really taking those fragments, but allowing them to, you know, to enable, the practice itself, and how you, I mean, constantly I think about this. I mean, how in the moment of when everybody's quoting, or where, maybe not anymore, but situationism, how do we, I feel that many of the, we need to pick up where those moments ended, you know, and that many of those tactics, you know, strategies can be operational once they are inserted into systems that, you know, that have contemporary relevancy and through the efforts we're trying to produce. So it's a kind of way of quoting, and enabling that quote to be functional, to be operational across, you know, a variety of texts. I mean, one of the most fundamental texts for me has been, you know, Chantal Mouffe's, you know, Art and Democracy. But just because of this notion of agonism, which goes back to the topic that we were talking about, because I've been interested in my intervention into public debate or public exchange, or let's call it urban pedagogy for a moment, where the project becomes one of just exposing the what she calls the hegemony of the institutional power. So this is a visualization of conflict. But for a moment it's about the debate itself becomes the without perpetuating the kind of fixity of the, you know, of the enemy and the way that we just polarize the debate, how do we enable a different conversation that produces conceptual possibilities, you know? So the debate itself becomes a project. For me, that was essential in Korea. It's like instead of just working with activists, I brought developers, politicians, and activists to really, through these instruments, with the models and many of the, we call the project conversations on coexistence. And that, you know, that is beginning. So that text is not just, you know, that text becomes functional.
But it's not just Chantal Mouffe that you're indebted to. It's also maybe like a Bakhtinian, like a dialogic idea. Like on some level, you want the developer to be implicated by the activist, and the activist to be implicated by somebody else's perspective. Is that what you're after in a way, would you say? I mean, you know, the other day you were explaining how this thought of the student from Lahore kind of was something in which the student was talking about the loss of a public space or the loss of an access to the public sphere, that this was something you were carrying around with you. That seems to me to suggest that it somehow implicated you, kind of. There was this way in which somebody else's comment kind of fundamentally impacted your own thinking about your work. Is that what you're also trying to think of as the outcome of these kinds of workshops?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think in that sense, it really elevates the meaning of this dialogical process, has become so essential to these notions of participation and collaboration in our time, and it's truly becomes alive. I mean, I think that the best moments in those exchanges with in this neighborhood in San Isidro where we work have been when a concept that is produced out of, you know, a conversation, of course, but like the example where this lady ended up calling her own neighborhood selfish, you know, in the way that she began to understand the kind of stupidity of this private house on private lot type of thing, right? And that she began to conceptualize in her own way that the whole block was a project, not the individual parcel, mm-hmm. and how can the collaboration of property owners could form a new morphology, a new kind of set of interactions. That's when she not only began to suggest that, I mean, that was a breakthrough because she began to reimagine her own context, which up to now had been completely inert as just a series of dumb houses, you know. That so that to me was a moment of opening, but also when she came back and suggested this kind of selfishness of this urbanization, which I borrowed in order to then construct a series of diagrams about it, and the whole pixelation of Southern California with the small, the largeness of Southern California being pixelated by the small, became, you know, truly emerged from that conversation. I don't know if that's what you are suggesting, but certain concepts. Part of the issue, again, is that this is like the inability of making these texts contaminate each other, making these sort of different spheres, high and low, you know, to really come and intertwine the kind of, I've been dissatisfied with this sort of reductive perception that the local is provincial, that, you know, that we already kind of auto-eliminate ourselves and the potential of producing a new imagination by encroaching into these other domains. So it's again, back to this issue of how we become facilitators of new, some of those new synergies. I mean, and the creative intelligence embedded in communities, and the high-end research that is being produced in universities needs to be reconnected, you know. And so, so that because much of the material becomes in itself just an act of reference or of display, never really a site of production once more. I mean, the text is a site of production. I mean, those concepts are fundamental.
I want to push you on the question of translation and translatability. You work with a border community in San Ysidro. You work in so many ways here in San Diego. You work in Tijuana. Can everything be translated across the border? I mean, these are communities and cultures that have so much in common, whether they acknowledge it or not. But there's also fundamental differences when you cross that border. Whether it's even the very idea of accessing something like a public space, public sphere, whether it's the visual language, there's so many fundamental cultural differences. How do you deal with that in your work? How do you negotiate in your practice and your thinking the question of translation and cultural difference?
Mm-hmm. And I many times say that just like we cannot operate only on the ideal realm, you know, without understanding the real, or at least we talked about the imbrication of the real and the ideal. Many of the movements or positions that have emerged from the border, the aspiration for this transborder metropolis and this sort of hybrid city, you know, I many times reacted against that because I wanted to suggest that any conversation needed to begin by a dialectical kind of condition here in terms of, you know, that this is primarily a kind of a site of difference. So these two places are very different. But at the same time, out of that, the understanding of that difference, beginning to understand in more accurate ways the commonalities, you know. So it's this sort of multiple or simultaneous way of flying and walking at the same time. How do we understand the differences? Converging again, because we're not going to deny that there are two different attitudes to the territory. At the same time, they have imbricated themselves. I mean, the impact of immigrants in the U.S. in redefining urbanization, in redefining the American neighborhood and retrofitting it, or the impact of the recycling of trash that has been the kind of part of, you know, understanding this research or these images at the border, in retrofitting the new suburbia of Tijuana. I mean, the fact that Tijuana builds itself with the waste of San Diego. So these multiple flows that, you know, suggest that the urbanism in this at this juncture is constantly shaped by the circulation of people and resources, goods, and, you know, is that this the dependence, you know, the codependence of these environments. So the translation of how small parcels in older neighborhoods are being retrofitted by immigrants into new systems, right, into which has inspired our project in San Isidro. Can a parcel perform? Can a parcel become a micro-infrastructural system of social and economic intelligence? Or, you know, not just the static repository of a house or an object, but it truly becomes a small socio-economic engine of sorts. That comes from the translation of how some parcels have been altered by immigrants in many of those neighborhoods. And through that translation, the organization of that parcel across different spaces and typologies of housing and economies. Can they coexist? So anyway, that's one process of translation. On the other end, in Tijuana, is the translation of informal settlements and how many of them are shaped by an interaction with boundaries, with economic support systems, recycling, levels of social organization, exploitation even, of course, but how the informal procedures embedded in those environments can also be translated to rethink ways of intervening in the city, in San Diego. And so the aspect of translation is how these informal dynamics of these informal flows, primarily I think the informal densities and economies at play, can really be the inspiration to rethink formal systems. So many times I say, you know, is this constant mediation between formal and informal, top-down and bottom-up in a sense? And across those registers, issues of appropriateness in a way. I mean, it's like what might be appropriate to San Isidro in its reconfiguration might not yet be appropriate in farther north in but it might be appropriate to Tijuana. So what I'm trying to say is that it's a constant negotiation with the idiosyncratic, the kind of a particular cultural attitudes towards space embedded in the specificity of a parcel or a community that need to be resolved for that particular condition, but at the same time with the agility, with the kind of inflexible ways that those set of relations that are responding to those idiosyncrasies can be translated at other scales, you know, in maybe other environments. So this is probably, I'm trying to think of the simultaneity of thinking of the specific problem, but then across its possible expansion or replicability at other scales. Because I get this question all the time, you're just working in a small scale, you're just working in this neighborhood. But I said, well, that's what I've been wanting to suggest, is that we, in the United States at this moment, we cannot begin from the top down. Let's begin small, because at the scale of experimentation, mainly when lending has been frozen, this is where we need to experiment in terms of pilot projects. But if we are tactical enough and also strategic enough to think how that can trickle up to other scales, we can suggest, and I'm maybe obsessed about this, is that the micro and the specificity of a parcel and the way it is organized can be the source to reimagine a whole region. So this correspondence of small and large, of thinking specifically in terms of differential systems at the scale of a parcel, but really catapulting that to levels of infrastructure. You know, it's that we're thinking simultaneously across the scales. That will be a requirement in my mind whenever we approach these projects. Is for San Isidro, yes, because it's a Hispanic neighborhood that operates in particular ways. But through that, we can really imagine how the border can be rethought, you know, at a more macro scale.
My sense is you may not want to answer this question. I feel like I sometimes tried to pull it out of you before, but. Do you identify with a particular history, or are there precedents that you want to situate your practice in relation to, not just recover potential kind of ideas from?
We need to do more of that. We need to radicalize history. I think that lately I'm becoming aware of the whole history of neighborhood activism, you know, some of the work that an architecture did in terms of reminding us in terms of in the context of the United States, the amazing tradition of activism at scale of neighborhoods. And you call it, I mean, so many other projects that it comes for one particular concept that you know that I've been interested in. It's interesting now because it has been moving around and other people are also in tandem recognizing the need for this, is that I've been arguing for rethinking or reobserving this border region, I've been interested in retroactively reconstruct somehow the what has produced the conflict, right? So when we worked on this project of the 60 linear miles across the border was a kind of, in a way, enacting a kind of forensics of the territory, that in every juncture where these ecologies collide, which therefore imply the collision of institutions that produce that conflict, the moment the freeway crashed with the creek, or the flattening of the topography by developers, in that conflict of top-down and bottom-up, I think that a task of research, which is a task of radicalizing those histories, is one of retroactively understanding what produced the crisis. What were the conditions and the procedures? Because without understanding that, it's difficult to infiltrate into those systems, to rethink new paradigms, I feel. Similarly, I think, in terms of precedent, you know, I think this is obvious what I'm saying, but even in the way we've been enabling some precedent has been, I think, extremely backward. Those movements, those references can be, would have to become operational in that sense. So the kind of more radical historiography is needed to demystify also certain concepts. Like recently, in this meeting with these people last week, somebody was mentioning about this book on a bit of feminist sort of agenda in terms of producing micro communities, but using infrastructure such as collective kitchens. And somebody who heard what we were trying to do in San Isidro in providing an infrastructure of service connected to housing to enable the existing socioeconomic entrepreneurship. So this, the issue of infrastructure is the availability of things to produce new interfaces with social configurations. It's a calibration of infrastructure and service, you know, and social organization. But there is a history about that. So perhaps there is this amazing history led by women in the 19th century in the United States. And there were two cases of that. So anyway, I think that this perennial recuperation of certain... But what I'm thinking that's the most interesting, people sometimes quote in these references, stop at the quotation, as we were saying before, and there is a task about translating those traces into practices that can be deployed in the context of, in fact, back to those sites of conflict, that kind of thing. I don't know if I'm getting to the...
Yeah, sure. I mean, perhaps this is a final question. You've spoken about the gap, the crisis, the cultural crisis of a gap that's emerged between cultural institutions and publics, between institutions more generally and publics. And clearly your work in San Isidro and your practice is an attempt to mitigate that gap and narrow it. When you look more broadly at the communities you're part of, the United States more generally, what do you see happening in the years ahead? Are you optimistic that this kind of gap may become less severe? In a way, mm-hmm. I guess I'm asking, mm-hmm. To what degree are you kind of optimistic about the years ahead? To what degree do you feel that your practice is kind of itself quite marginal and crucial in what you do, but at the same time an isolated example in a much larger mm-hmm. kind of topography of the United States?
Yes, no, I think that usually I operate based, as maybe all of us, based on this optimistic pessimism, okay? Because first we have to get pissed off, you know, and there is a level of fatalism. I mean, the whole debate in the United States right now, the kind of ignorance, the kind of polarization, how easy the public can be co-opted by the politics of fear. I mean, the whole debacle of the health debate, you know, that was compromised at the end. The whole absence of the most progressive faction in this country to enable an environmental policy suggests that there is still this sort of subordination of political leaders to an easily misdirected public. and ultimately the fear of the public itself, the eroding of public institutions, the fear of even engaging into the debate about the public, you know, this. So this, as all of, I mean, it really got me upset. I mean, it's really suggested that the main site of intervention is that gap between the institutions and the public, and the awareness and the kind of misinformation of the public. And I couldn't believe that the Obama administration would not suggest that in terms of tax cuts, I'm sorry to divert, but they were in fact providing tax cuts to 75% of the population based on, it was a simple equation in my mind. But yet the right kept saying that Obama was about increasing taxes, you know, and about this other, you know. So anyway, the point is that there is a process by which I think that we need to produce this sort of new interfaces with the public itself. And I began to look, this is where the optimism emerges, to look at other sites where that had become the project and had been the source to produce new types of ideas about urbanization. So therefore, my infatuation with many of the successful and very interesting progressive projects in Latin America. When I began to look at Curitiba in Brazil, when I began to look at Porto Alegre in Brazil, where somewhere in the late 70s they enacted this interesting policy called participatory budgets, where this very progressive mayor suggested that communities could have a say in the reorganization of municipal budgets. Very interesting set of dialogues and so on. Or, of course, Jamie Lerner in Curitiba. And then when I began to discover, of course, what happened in Bogota with Antanas Mockus, who enabled or aspired to this project of urban pedagogy, saying that the only way to really prepare the ground for a more progressive idea of urbanization was to engage the public in its imagination. So this, and that, you know, this aspiration to reconnect public policy with the collective imagination. When I began to talk to many of them, I actually spoke to many of those mayors, that was, in fact, for all of them, the main referent. The main point of departure was a very different engagement of the public. And so Antanas Mockus produced an amazing project of civic culture, as he called it, the kind of, and then that paved the way to the project that Enrique Peñalosa did later in terms of the transportation system called the Transmillennium, and then ending with Sergio Fajardo in Medellin, who, as you know, produced this very interesting series of hybrid public spaces linking public libraries with parks and so on. But it's interesting because many of these people emerged came from the humanities, philosophers, mathematicians, complexity theory kind of proponents, and they began to establish a very different communication. So all I'm trying to say is that the optimism comes to suggest that in some environments in the world, this reconnection has allowed a very different idea of infrastructure and urbanization, but were not really enabled, many of those projects in Latin America, by the kind of mimicking or the reproduction of, at times, U.S. kind of led way of thinking of development in terms of this global, more glamorous version of globalization. But they were probably some of the few governments in the world that were looking at, in fact, social networks, informal economies, other kind of degrees of participation to formulate a different agenda, you know, towards infrastructure and so on. I'm thinking that borrowing some of those histories it continues to be, in my mind, a project. But translating them into systems that can be replicated at different degrees in our own environment. But again, the very interesting premise that many of those projects, which leads me to, again, maybe one of the final issues here in my mind, is that the future, at least in short term, of urbanization in our time, if we were to think and aspire to a more radical idea of democracy and therefore urbanization, will not be led by buildings, but in fact by the reconfiguration of social and economic relations, without allowing that to be the kind of new stew that enables a new way of physicalizing or, producing infrastructure. I think it's very difficult to transcend the recipes that have proven themselves wrong and that continue to be replicated in Asia at this moment. So anyway, but the point is that the inspiration then as a base is a new type of interface with the public. And in that sense, yes, entering into a very new, that word can also be dangerously new, but a more radical approach to education at other scales, of the civic, to produce a new civic imagination, becomes also an act, a kind of project for us as architects, designers, entering into that. So that, to me, at this moment, I'm interested that to be what might lead the future, particularly in this country.
Thank you, Teddy.